Welcome to the Blackhawks Talk podcast. On this installment, Scott King of NBCSportsChicago.com catches up with 2010 Stanley Cup champion Brent Sopel. Sopel discusses the Blackhawks rebuild back in 2007 and 8, one he was, of course, a part of, and compares it to the current rebuild going on at 1901 West Madison. They share some untapped 2010 Stanley Cup storylines, and Brent continues to work with dyslexia awareness. It's all coming up on the Blackhawks Talk podcast.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Born in the Rockies, Coors Light is lagered cold for a crisp, clean taste. Filtered cold to ensure clarity and brightness. And packaged cold for peak refreshment. Because those who thirst for more deserve the world's most refreshing beer.
Scott King here with 2010 Stanley Cup champ Brent Sopel. And Brent, you know, I watched your documentary, the full title, Brent Sopel, Here to Change the World. You can watch it now on YouTube. Great stuff, you know, just a great resource for talking about your hockey days and, more importantly, spreading dyslexia awareness and helping individuals with dyslexia. And not to mention, you know, it touches on, and I want to promote the Brent Sopel Foundation, brentsopelfoundation.org, the incredible work you've done there. I mean, how's everything going, man? You're in Tampa. You started your own business. I'll ask you about that a little later. But first, just the work you do and what you've touched on in a documentary right now seems like it would have limited a guy like you, because I know you were about to meet with Lori Lightfoot. The last time I talked to you, you're going to meet with Governor Pritzker about spreading dyslexia awareness. You're even getting screened to meet with the president. But I also know you're not a guy that lets stuff kind of throw you off the road or deter you. So what's it been like trying to help as many people as you're accustomed to helping during the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, thanks for taking time. I know you're busy with three kids running around the house. So fitting me in there, I feel pretty special. This COVID, the sad part is that, there's people passing away and there's people sick. So let's not lose light of that. But it's been great, for parents, with dyslexic kids or kids with learning disorders. You know, your kids struggled, but you really didn't know how much. Why? Because how much time kids spend more time at school than they do at home, with the parents working. And if you're working 9 to 5, you drop them off at school and you don't get home till dinner time and do a little bit of homework, then we're off to bed. So they really didn't understand the full length of what it meant to struggle. And now with this e-learning and trying to figure out that e-learning fun stuff that everybody's trying to do now. But, now they get to see their kids struggle for hours on end, and they really have the understanding of what their kids go through on a better, more extreme level, so that they're there to advocate for their kids. And, if your kids don't have their parents to advocate for them, who do they have?
Yeah, I don't know if you caught it, Brent, but we had a 2010 team reunion for our COVID-19 relief on NBC Sports Chicago. Back then, it felt like, we were deep into the pandemic. Now it's just like, that was just like the early phases of it.
That seems like 2 years ago.
I know. So in that, I wanted to ask you, because in that doc, you have Brent Seabrook talking at length about how much you meant to that 2010 team. Ladd, Brower, and Versteeg dubbed you the unsung hero of the 2010 Stanley Cup champion Blackhawks. They mentioned Yarmolson in the ranks there as well as an unsung hero. But I mean, what is it? Sounds like you might've seen that. What does it mean to you to have all those guys saying those things about you? Cause a lot of times, a role like yours, all the sacrifices you make, it does kind of go, fly under the radar. So to hear those guys talk about you that way? What does it mean to you?
Yeah, you know, it's you know, it's pretty special for me. Like you said, the role that I that I lived and ate those pucks every single day, that people would say, you know, I did it. You know, I did it for them. You know, we're a team. Everybody's got a role, and that was my role. So, you know, anytime you you talk about the most valuable player, and in the NHL, is it who's it voted by, the players? Or is it by the media? Which one is it? You know, it's always anything from your peers. it's special, you know, from your teammates and, you know, with those guys and watching them grow up and watching guys, you know, they have kids now. And, you know, when I first came to Chicago, I think my kids were closer in age in Kane and Taves than I was to Kane and Taves. So, you know, to watch everybody grow the way they did and come together that year, and, you know, they're always will be special in my heart, but to hear guys say that, you know, like your peers, you know, I heard it, I've seen it, and it means a lot to me.
So 12 NHL seasons, 659 regular season games, 71 playoff games. You were +7 in the 2010 Cup playoffs, where you blocked 54 shots in 22 games. I mean, you talk about sacrificing. And then I want to get to how you join the Hawks. I never actually talked to you about this, but you were invited to the Red Wings camp ahead of 07-08. They make you an offer, not a great offer, and just for 1 year, and you leave that camp and sign with the Hawks for 3 years and more money. So really worked out for you, really worked out for Blackhawks fans, I would say. I mean, how did that all kind of unfold?
I'll clear up a few things on there. You know, so you're right, I was in LA, got traded to Vancouver. We lost to Anaheim in the second round. That's the year they went and won it. I didn't play very well. So rightfully so, it was my fault. So there was no contract offers. I got an offer to come to training camp Detroit. Yeah, and then they did offer me a one-year deal. But I would have been splitting time between Chris Chelios. And now let me think, Brent Sobel and Chris Chelios, there's really not much comparison. So we were talking to a few different teams, and Chicago and Dale Tallon was one of them, and reached out to Dale after the 1 year deal was offered to me. And he only offered me a 1 year deal, but he said, come to Chicago, I want you to have a role of playing top 4 minutes, but being a leader and teaching these young kids. We had Kane and Taze coming in. I want you to teach them how to be a pro each and every day. And I've always been, being a dyslexic kid, I'm always there to help. I was always there to teach, I think I was grandpa of the team, but that role is what excited me. It was a tad bit more money, but, that extension came, after the quarter, halfway through the season. So, it falls on Dale's back to call and bring me in. He was the mastermind of bringing me to Chicago. So I got to give all the credit to him. He offered me, roles that I love. In Detroit, I walked away from amazing guys and teams, to come to Chicago to have, they end up winning the Stanley Cup that year in Detroit. So, but the ability to watch these young guys and, hopefully help them, mentor them to having long careers. I hope positively affected their careers to where it is today.
So if you don't get to Chicago and get that extension, that's 54 shots are not blocked in those playoffs. I mean, a lot of big PK moments and obviously setting up the Hossa goal out of the box against Nashville. So, I mean, like, what a strong argument that, without Sopel, that championship might not happen. Maybe they find a way with the talent they had, but my God, you talk about a butterfly effect. Were you thinking about, were you entertaining being a wing or another team? I know you said you don't want to go up against Chelios, but that's Chelios later in his career. Well,
yeah, there's no questions. If Dale didn't put the sales pitch that he put on and playing top 4 minutes, and that was it. I wasn't going to leave Detroit. You talk about, Chelios, yes, that was in later career. So him and I were we going to split games, 50-50? I was going to be the seventh D-man. Could have been injuries, in training camp. I was playing with Nick Lidstrom, Nick Lidstrom, obviously the best defenseman, one of the best ever to play the game, one of the nicest human beings in the world. Well, you know, so was I entertaining that? Yes, I was entertaining that very strong. So, you know, Dale sales pitch, what he did and said, you know, was the one that sold me. So you got to give, like I said, you got to give a lot of credit to Dale.
So you come to Chicago, and I know you're asked to mentor Seabrook and Keith as well. That time when you get there in 07, 08, they played a couple seasons, you know, some top minutes there, mostly together as a D pairing. What's it like, I guess, how were you asked to approach mentoring these guys, taking these guys under your wing, and how did it unfold? What did they take to that you said, and what was it like to work with them?
Well, amazing. You know, obviously they've been in the league for a little while. You know, obviously we wouldn't, you know, as Blackhawks fans and players, we wouldn't have three cups if it wasn't for those two. You know, the absolute horses, what they've done. You know what they took? I don't know. You'd have to ask them that. You know, I'm a guy that I was always talking. You know, it's just, you know, I see the world being different. Dyslexia, as I saw the ice differently. So I was just always just little nuances that I was trying to teach them. But, you know, the hardest part to be being an NHLer is consistency. You know, night in and night out, you know, they talk about football being the toughest. You know, we've got 82 games and it's a grind and we're flying here in time zones. And it's hard. You know, there's many days as I, you know, waking up there, you know, obviously in pain, but I had to go back out there and do it again. And, you know, it was doing things like that. Practice, you have to practice what you play. It's not a light switch. So every time we're on the ice, we're going 100% because, you know, practice is where you learn. That's where you can work on things and get better. So it was a combination of so many little things, you know, over the time, but what they took, you'd have to ask them that.
The way things are playing out now, you know, kind of a slow rebuild the last couple of years. You have Keith mentoring Henry Yokoharu before he gets traded at the blue line, and then certainly Adam Boqvist last year. And now both those guys are in position where you're going to get a very young defense next season as the team rebuilds around the core four. Is it strange for you to see those guys, Seabrook and Keith, mentoring some people coming in now?
Yeah, it really makes me feel old. But that's, you know, like I said, those guys are the reason why, you know, three cups and, you know, the word dynasty has been wrapped around the Blackhawks organization. So, you know, for Boqvist and those guys to learn from those guys, no better guys to learn from. Obviously, two types of guys to watch. And, you know, if Boqvist can, you know, kind of take a little bit from both, you know, obviously you can skate offensively, but, you know, to be the top D-man, you've got to be able to, you know, play in your own end. You know, I think Quinville always said your best offense, you know, is good defense and, you know, keep that puck out of your net. So it is weird. I guess I feel real old now that they both have kids and now they're the mentors, but it's awesome to see.
I want to ask you about Yarmolson, the other unsung hero, according to some teammates. Did you just kind of always feel like he was willing to pay the price early on, you know, the way you were in terms of sacrificing your body to block shots? And did you notice some skill with him also in those days?
Oh, yeah, there's no question. He had a lot of skill. But as D-man, I didn't want the puck. There's guys there's guys up front that I, you know, needed to get to. Kane, Tays, Hosts, you know, the list goes on. Yarmolson, you know, he's a guy that's so smart. He doesn't get credit for how smart he is. You know, stick position, how many pucks he knocks, you know, out of the air by being in that smart position. And that's, you know, he was willing to sacrifice like myself. You've got to be able to know that you're going to get hurt. And if I wasn't hurt every game, meaning I wasn't doing my job, but he's got a lot of skill, you know, very smart. And, you know, if it wasn't for, you know, I don't know how many shots he blocked that, you know, never mind the 2010, but 13 to 15, what he did, you know, he's an unsung hero. There's no question. He's not unsung in my mind. He's, you know, ahead, you know, he's front and center when it comes to that. You know, you can play 30 minutes, but there's easy minutes and hard minutes. And that penalty kill is definitely the hard minutes.
So the Hawks were in an interesting phase of their rebuild. You know, I think some dividends are starting to pay off. When you were there, 07, 08, finished third in the Central Division, but don't make the playoffs. That's Kane's rookie year. you, like I said, Seabrook and Key starting to play some top minutes for a while. Sharp had been there a couple seasons. Is that what it felt like to you, that you guys are in a rebuild, but things are starting to pay off?
Well, you know, the Sydney Chicago organization was in a rebuild for years. You know, I was playing, used to come in, you know, Vancouver, we'd come to Chicago, amazing city, stay in downtown, go down to Rush, go to dinner. You know, we're like, oh, now we got to go play hockey. Now we got to go to this United Center to play against this bad team with no fans. You know, so you know, the history behind it that, you know, Hawks struggled for a while, but, you know, you could see early in the season that we're going to start trending in the right direction. The pieces were starting to fall into place. And again, two best draft picks, you know, if you don't have Kane and Taves, you know, things don't happen, you know. So they were the glue to this organization, getting it to where it is. And, you know, it wasn't long till you could see that we're starting to trend in the right direction.
You cut to where things are now with the rebuilding process for the current team. You know, it's around the core four, but you're going to have three inexperienced goalies compete for the starter spot. You're getting new young D-men in. How tough of a road do you think these guys are going to have when they start playing next year and trying to build and build team chemistry and get guys experience and all that? How tough is it going to be for this team?
Well, you know, the biggest position in you know, in the NHL is goaltending. You know, go back to my days in Vancouver, we had some of the best teams and we struggled in goalie. We cycled guys through and, you know, obviously getting rid of Corey Crawford. I'm not understanding, you know, I still don't understand why. You know, I could understand if you had, you know, maybe Carter Hart in Philadelphia, you know, they kept him in the minors for Lexter, brought him up early, or Carey Price, or you had somebody in the, you know, waiting in the wings that you knew was going to be your number one. They don't. So I'm not, you know, I made a lot of mistakes in my career. And, you know, Corey Crawford, Niemi, Huey, list goes on. The guys that played in front of Luongo, they saved my ass. You know, being a defenseman, your last year, you turn, you need your goalie to save your ass every once in a while. And those guys did. And, you know, are these young guys ready to do that? You know, we'll find out. But it's the hardest position. And now with the new NHL, you can't have a guy, Marty Brodeur, play 72 games. Now it's almost a 60-40 split because of the pressure. And if we do come back in January, it's going to be a condensed season. There isn't going to be a lot of days off. So you're going to have to count on two goalies for sure. And, you know, right now Blackhawks, you know, in my mind, don't have any.
Getting to the documentary, again, it touches on how you've struggled with dyslexia and the way you use your platform as a Stanley Cup champ to help others. Just spell it out, because I think, you know, obviously not intentionally, but a lot of people are ignorant when it comes to dyslexia. They really don't understand, because it seems like one of those things where you don't fully understand unless you have it. I guess you can kind of spell out what it is and what it's like to experience.
No, you're exactly right. The way I always, you know, described it, it's like a kind of like a bowling alley. Lane one is guys, lane two is girls, lane three is dyslexic guys, lane four is dyslexic girls. While three and four can mold into one and two, we know what's going on in your world. But one and two have absolutely no idea what it is going on in our world every single day. You know, how we struggle every day, how hard we got to work to try and read something, trying to memorize something. You know, for example, how my brain works, if I'm driving down the highway, I will tell you every single license plate on every car, truck, semi, I go by or goes by me. That's how my brain works. So I'm always out there. There's no straight line. You guys are straight line A to B in the world. We're not, we have to zigzag. So, you know, a lot of people think dyslexics just flip their B's and D's. Yeah. That's a very, very small portion of it. You know, for example, reading comprehension for myself, I never remember what I'm reading. If a word doesn't spell and sound out the same way, I'll never understand how to spell that. The most severe dyslexics will never read a day in their life.
Want to point out too, there's some very notable people, creative, intelligent people that have dyslexia. Spielberg, John Lennon had it. Henry Winkler, who I know you met. Keanu Reeves, and as you point out in the documentary, half of NASA. So, you know, a lot of people struggle with it, and lot of times they're very intelligent and creative, and they find ways to cope with it.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, being in Chicago, obviously Chicago gets the rap of what's going on with the murders and everything like that. But 50% of people in prison in the world have dyslexia. So everything that's going on down the south side, I guarantee, you know, 60, 70, 80% of them can't read. Now, here in the world, if you're not good at math, which I'm not, there's a job. You know, what? There's something for you. But if you can't read, what can you do? You know, so we're letting down the world. We're letting down the youth by not, you know, getting every kid tested and understanding, you know, how they learn. It's just, you know, Sam drove me 10 miles. All right, I have no idea what you said, but let's show me a video and let's talk this through a video. Okay, you know, I have a better understanding.
Documentary touches on your playing career a lot too. A lot of great highlights there. You say you're injured more than half of your career you played injured, maybe even two-thirds of it, I think. I mean, you know, you might not have been the only guy, but even back then, even when the game was really tough, that seems pretty crazy.
Well, you know, for example, when I was in LA, I think I broke my hand 3 times, and I think I had a cast on just about the whole year. At one point in time, I was playing with a cast on my left hand, and it broke my right ankle. I was playing with both. That's just, you know, obviously, I was a guy that started off as an offensive defenseman, but, you know, I had to mold my game into, you know, being more of the 54 block shots in the 2010 Stanley Cup playoffs. And yeah, if I wasn't hurt, I wasn't doing, you know, I wasn't in the game. I wasn't in the mix. I wasn't doing what I needed to do. And yeah, my injuries, they weren't little. It was always breaking something because I was putting myself, you know, in that position, and, you know, broken kneecap to hands, fingers, wrists, you know, but that's the price you pay. And that's what I had to do to do what I did. And, you know, I wouldn't change it because I've got this platform, you know, for my foundation. That's what I'm most proud of, is not the cup. It's not my career. It's the fact that I have a platform now to help kids.
Something I definitely wanted to point out from the documentary is you talk at length about your low self-esteem that you've dealt with because of dyslexia. And I know you've told me in the past that, you know, it's usually not more than a quarter tank full for you. Point to how much that guys deal with that, you know, that get that. I know that you said it was in ninth grade and you kind of had to stand in front of the class and read. And that was the moment it was obvious that you couldn't read. You weren't able to get help with dyslexia until you were 32. So, I mean, what a struggle it is, right?
Well, you know, we're dyslexic. So we're born with a right brain wired differently, you know, so it's not autism that, you know, that they talk about maybe from, you know, how they get the injection or medicine or whatever it is. We're born with a right brain wired. So there's nothing, no pill, there's no shots, there's nothing there to fix it. We start struggling from the first time we pick up that book. Is that 2 years, 3 years old, 4 years old, whatever that is. So guys like Robin Williams had dyslexia, but they ever talked about his depression. They talk about everything else. Dyslexia kicks off everything else. Your bipolar, your depression, you know, you start struggling at 2 years old. Your depression isn't there. Your bipolar isn't there. So, you know, your dyslexia and self-esteem go hand in hand. You know, we have none. And now you could be the smartest guy in the world, but if you don't have self-esteem, you have nothing. And as guys, you know, you're supposed to provide for your wives and your children. And when you can't, you know, there's a reason why the suicide rate for men is so high. It takes everything out of you. And when you take away hockey, as you took away from me, it wasn't pretty.
I want to congratulate you too. You told me before we started recording here, you are 4 years sober, and that's phenomenal. I know that's something you talk about in the documentary too, is it was an intervention from family and friends that really kind of saved your life and helped you. There was a point where you've been trying to sell your Stanley Cup ring. I mean, it sounds like you're doing great now. And you watch some of the kids' testimonials in the documentary that are saying, you know, you changed their lives around with your work and your foundation. You know, so I guess it seems like their self-esteem is higher because of your work. So, you know, not to play Dr. Phil here, Brent, but is there anything you can do for yourself? Because I think, you know, you're a guy who deserves to to feel good, no matter what you're dealing with. And I think you make others feel good.
Well, you know, it's, and that's why I try and do it. You know, I tell my story. I tell it as real as it is, as painful as it is for people. I want everybody to understand, you know, getting to kids early is what I'm trying to do. You know, I was 32, 33 years old. So the scars I have are obviously deeper, bigger, longer, worse than, you know, the kids in the documentary, because I got to them at a young age. And that's what it is. You know, I'm great today. You know, I'm here today. I woke up and, you know, what is it? 2 million people don't wake up every day. So I'm blessed to be here today. And you know, you taking the time out of your busy day with your kids, just because you don't know who this message is going to make, you know, going to get to. And I always say that, please share whatever about my foundation, my documentary, and it's not for me. Because you really don't know who this is going to hear it, who's going to see it, read it, watch it. And I can honestly say it can save somebody's life. Because if you don't have it, you really don't know what the struggle is. So, you know, for you to, you know, take the time and you know, have me on is obviously truly special. I appreciate that.
No, I appreciate you joining me, man. And just a couple more for you. Last time I talked to you was in April for a story, and you had just become a grandpa. You were helping get kids. You're helping get kids into rehabs. It seemed like around the world from your home in Rosemont. I know you're telling me you got a kid to stay in rehab for 50 days in Vancouver, and there was another guy you were talking to in Idaho, I think. Now you moved to Tampa and you started your own business. Can you kind of talk about that part of your life?
Yeah, I already, you know, helped put somebody in rehab here too. The reason I'm an open book is because there's no better feeling than helping somebody. You know, I want my legacy to be my foundation and, you know, and not hockey. Hockey was great to me, no question, but, you know, helping somebody, you know, saving somebody's life or putting somebody down a good path instead of the wrong path. There's no better feeling. That's why, you know, I always say, you know, you need something, please reach out. You know, I'll get back to you whenever, however. I'll do whatever I can to help anybody in this world. You know, we've got one life to live in this world, trying to make it the best. You know, I've made many mistakes. We'll continue to make mistakes, but there's no better way to live life than, you know, trying to help people, you know, better themselves.
Last question I want to ask you. You told me something real interesting about the 2010 team before, and you didn't really credit winning the cup to talent necessarily. It was kind of that no matter the age or who the guys were on the team, everyone was on that same kind of even keeled mentality throughout the entire playoffs. And you don't hear a lot of people talk about that. I think it's really interesting. You said, you know, you're saying to kind of avoid that roller coaster. You want to avoid those high highs and low lows and just, you know, kind of take it game by game. Can you talk about that? How huge that is for teams still today?
Well, you know, it's funny. Everybody's like, oh, you're going to give me a cliche answer. There's a reason why they're called cliche, because they're true. And, you know, obviously the Stanley Cup is the hardest trophy out of the four major sports, you know, to win. You know, I think football, they get, what, three games? We're not even out of the first round and they're done. You know, there's injuries that happen. Guys are playing hurt, bad bounces. Just go back to, you know, Hostess game, you know, game winner. You know, it's a five-minute major, you know, Tanner ties it up, comes out of the box. You know, everything's got to line perfectly to win the Stanley Cup. You know, we had injuries 100%, but did we have any major injuries? No. And where the Stanley Cup is won is your third and fourth line and, you know, your four, five, six, seven teammen. Because everybody's got a good top two lines. You know, you always look at the top scoring in the playoffs. You take a look at, you know, Ben and Sagan were, you know, Radulov were the top three in Dallas this year. You know, Kucherov, you know, they're top guys. They kind of wash each other out, are very close to wash each other out. All right, how's your third line doing? You know, Dave Bolin, you know, how did he play? Unbelievable. You know, Andrew Ladd was at my line, Versteeg, Kopecky. Those are some teams' first line. You know, then you go to the third line, and, you know, they go to our fourth line. You know, Ben Eager, you know, big goal, game, you know, in I think that was game two. Your twisted wrist, or, you know, Burrish, you know, Colin Fraser, you know, those are guys, again, guys, you know, third, you know, maybe some second line, you know, players in some of those teams. So that's who wins it, you know, for us. Nick Boynton comes in, plays well. You know, Brian Campbell comes in late after breaking his collarbone. He didn't come to the first round. So, you know, all the stars got to be perfectly aligned, but you can't ride the highs and highs. You got to stay level. You got to win four games. It's a 7-game series. And our guy, John Madden, did a great job, helping guys along with that. And, you know, it was the tightest knit team that I've ever been a part of, and obviously proved it at the end.
Awesome stuff, Brent. Again, I tell everybody to go check out BrentSopelFoundation.org. Check on the awesome work Brent has been doing using his platform as a Stanley Cup champ to do. And check out Brent Sopel, Here to Change the World on YouTube. A great, great documentary. Brent, glad you're doing so well, man. Thanks so much for your time.
No, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So that's a wrap on this Blackhawks Talk podcast. Our thanks to Stanley Cup champion Brent Sopel and Scott King of NBCSportsChicago.com. We thank you for listening as always. Don't forget to rate us, and we'll catch you next time on the Blackhawks Talk podcast.